I think I heard once that her daddy divorced her mama when she was but little, and that he went on to have several more wives and children. Litters, these girls used to call them, self-mocking. And whether or not that story was true, she wasn't a happy girl. Hyacinth, whatever her name, she took to hating me straight off, and I made no scruple about returning that sentiment. Circled each other all freshman year like a pair of feral cats, while her friends sneered and snooted in approval. And my friends? Well, I didn't have any, did I? Just Geneva Kelly from River Junction, Maryland, all on her own. Not even a mama and daddy to see her settled in at college that first week. Come May, end of the year looming, Hyacinth made her move. Took umbrage at some remark of mine, some insult to her intellect for which I claim full responsibility, while we sat too close in the stale lecture hall to discuss the classical philosophers. Push came to shove, and as I turned the corner of the dormitory hall the next day, dressed in my tatty old robe, carrying my toothbrush, I'll be damned if that well-bred girl from a top-drawer family didn't just sucker-punch me like no girl or boy in River Junction would ever stoop so low as to punch another girl or boy. I could do nothing but fall to the ground and wake up in the infirmary. And though the college president herself interviewed me later, I never would say who done it. I never would rat that Hyacinth out, even though she deserved ratting for a sucker punch like she gave me. Because we may be poor as church mice in River Junction, but we are surely not rats. We take care of our trouble ourselves. And I took care of that Hyacinth as soon as I came out of the infirmary. Anyway, what I neglected to tell you before was this. I did not precisely drop out of Bryn Mawr College in the summer of 1920. I was kicked out on account of busting Hyacinth's nose. 16. But that's not the point of the story. The point is this. I swore, in the time of Hyacinth, never again to allow myself to be taken by surprise like that. Never again to turn a corner or walk through a door without expecting some kind of unpleasant surprise waiting for me. Someone lying in wait to do me an ill turn. The thing is, though, that's a promise you can't keep, however so vigilant you may be. Sooner or later you let your guard drop. Sooner or later, you allow yourself to be distracted by the turnings of your own mind, by the slings and the arrows and the thunderbolts. And sooner or later, someone's going to catch you when you're alone and vulnerable, when you've neglected to cover over your white nakedness before the world, when you're emerging from a powder room and your nerves and your dignity aren't altogether intact, and a fellow stands there in a dark pinstriped suit just about bursting from his chest, and he's got a heavy black revolver in one hand that he doesn't actually point at you. Just lifts up as if to strike you across the cheekbone. And such is your shock, you can't even scream. Your throat freezes up. Your hands rise to block this blow that can't possibly be blocked. Not when delivered by an arm so powerful as that. You stumble back into the powder room, but you don't get far because the arm is swift, and you shut your eyes and try to dodge the blow, dodge down and around this mountain of man-flesh, swinging his revolver in a damn sucker punch. Except there's no chance, no room to dodge, no time to dodge in. And then you realize you're still alive. You haven't been hit. You're falling to the ground, sure, but not on account of some blow to your cheekbone. Just you. Stumbling to the floor all on your own, and somebody grunting above you. You hit the chipped tile floor of the powder room kind of hard, knocking out a bit of wind from your chest. But a second later, someone's lifting you up. And you open your eyes, and what do you know? Nice mustache, you say? 17. There's a back door at Christopher's, a door I never knew about, but Anson knows it, back of the broom closet behind a bucket full of mops. Might coulda come in handy at the end of January when this whole mess began. Might have stopped all this trouble in its tracks. I tell him this as we duck through this doorway into the rot-laden courtyard behind the building. Wouldn't have made any difference, he says. I'd have found you anyway. 18. In my bedroom now, where I'm daubing Agent Anson's knuckles with iodine, attempting to calm the furious rhythm of my circulation. So who in the Lord's name was that? I ask.
Who?
Who? That fella who just about cracked my head wide open, that's who. Stop flinching. What are you, some kind of sissy? You can bust a man's jaw, but you can't take a little medicine.
I have no idea who he is. I was hoping you might.
Never saw him before. I reach for the roll of gauze. I figure if I can concentrate on these simple tasks, iodine and gauze, I can keep myself steady, trick myself sane. He's got big, bony hands, Agent Anson, more long than wide, and this new scar across the knuckles of his right hand isn't the first. I take a firm grip on the pad of his thumb and wind the gauze carefully around his palm. Buddy followed us all the way over from Hudson Street. My friend Anatole has a studio there.
Yes, I know.
He was waiting outside, I think. I tie together the ends of the gauze, nice and snug, and I give the knuckles a pat, just to make him wince. But I don't let go of the hand, and he doesn't pull it away. Just standing there, the pair of us, one paw stuck between the paws of the other, moon coming in through the window, turning the gauze silver. I trace the edge of his fingernail with my thumb. How long have you played the clarinet?
Since I was about 8, I guess.
And where did you join Bruno's orchestra?
2 weeks ago.
Does Bruno know?
He knows I'm a friend of yours.
I look up into the wall above his gaze. Anything else I should know about you, Tarzan, since you seem to know so much about me?
What do you want to know?
Anything. Maybe everything. He withdraws the precious hand and turns to the bureau, picks up the roll of gauze and winds it back up.
There isn't much to know, really.
Oh, I think there's a lot to know, but you're one of those fellows who like to keep his beans to himself, as I recollect. All I figure is that you're not married, and you don't have any kids, and you come from some kind of money, and know a Harvard crest from a crack in the sidewalk, and you can knock a man out cold in one blow, which is something a girl like me can respect, believe me.
Look, he says, setting down the gauze, turning to face me. Let's get back to the business at hand. You're certain you've never seen that man before.
Positive. I tap my temple. I never forget a face.
He's not from Maryland.
If you mean is he one of Duke's pals from River Junction, he's not. Must be some local Dukes rustled up.
But you're certain Duke sent him, is that right? Sent this man to hurt you.
As sure as I can be.
Why?
Because as I told you, or at least as I told your secretary to inform you, Dukes cut me off. No parcels in a week. Truth to tell, I've been expecting something like this for days now. I jerk my thumb toward the moon outside. He must have figured out I'm working for you.
That's impossible. We haven't met in weeks. I haven't yet acted on any of the information you've given me.
But you've been lurking around, keeping watch on me.
He hesitates. Yes, to protect you.
So maybe somebody spotted you, playing your clarinet or something, saw through that clever disguise of yours.
That's unlikely.
But possible.
Not impossible, I suppose.
I sit down on the bed and fold my arms. So I guess it's over. The jig's up.
No, it isn't. Not by a long shot. I'm going to get busy as soon as I'm out this window, find out who that fellow is, who he's working for. I don't think it's your stepfather.
He moves to the window, just a couple of steps for those thick, tough legs of his, and peers out as if contemplating possible routes of departure. A sound escapes him, and if I didn't know any better, I could swear that Agent Anson, straight as an arrow, pure as a bar of ivory soap, just took the name of his lord in vain. Why not?
Hmm?
Why don't you think he's one of Duke's men?
Anson lets fall the curtain and turns to me.
Because he had a revolver, and Mr. Kelly's men don't use guns.
Applesauce.
It's true. Don't you know he doesn't hold with guns?
Of course I know that, but you can't run a bootleg racket without a Chicago typewriter in one hand and a revolver in the other. Nobody but a fool would try it.
Oh, his men carry guns on the road, of course, in case of ambush. But anything else, when he sends someone out to deliver a message of some kind, settle a score. He does it the old-fashioned way.
Anson lifts his hand and examines the bandage on his knuckles.
Because you don't hunt down a man like you would, a mere animal.
Lord Almighty!
So I believe we can rest assured that your stepfather, for all his faults, isn't the fellow behind tonight's incident.
Goodness me, what a terrible, great relief. In that case, I'll sleep like a baby. The fellow actually smiles at me.
Wake up howling every few hours, then?
Oh, and just what do you know about the sleeping habits of babies, Mr. Anson?
I know a little something about just about everything, Miss Kelly.
Well, then, maybe you can answer me this. Just out of idle curiosity, mind you. I don't suppose you've got any idea who else might be responsible for trying to darken my lights, if not Duke.
I don't know the answer to that question at present. But believe me, I won't rest until I find out.
And what am I supposed to do in the meantime? Lock myself in my room? Hire a Pinkerton guard?
You don't need to hire a Pinkerton guard, Anson says. You have me for that purpose.
You know, I never did shift clothes after posing for Anatole and Julie. I'm still wearing my same plain skirt and blouse, my everyday clothes, nothing to catch a man's eye. Just the lipstick I applied in the powder room a half hour ago. Next to Millie, I reckon I must have looked like someone the dog drug home from the library. And a girl who isn't looking her absolute best, what shot has she got in this modern world? A girl all alone, what possible hope? Just her own wits, her own strength. So I am standing there atop my bedroom floor in my plain skirt and blouse, thinking someone is fixing to kill me. Somebody wants me dead. I'm in trouble dire. A girl all alone like a sapling springing forth from a prairie field. And Mr. Agent Anson, he goes and says a thing like that. You have me. Have you found out anything more about my buttons? I ask.
Agent Anson sticks his left hand into the pocket of his overcoat and draws out a small package wrapped in brown paper. He sets it on the bureau and unwraps the paper.
Mama's box.
Not much, he says. Thought I recognized the decoration, but it turns out the shop was closed up long ago. I'll see if I can't find anyone who might know more.
Don't go to any trouble now.
It's no trouble.
His hand falls away from the box. He's only a yard away.
You're only about a yard away from anything in my little room.
And from this intimate distance, I observe the comfort of his pulse at the side of his neck, the thrum of his tendons, living and breathing and beaten, I think. We are standing here just as we were a few weeks ago, just exactly like this, betwixt the bed and the dresser, right in front of the window. Except it's not the same at all. It is somehow entirely different. Different tenor between us. Different atmosphere. As if the earth has revolved its way into a strange new portion of the universe in the period since we stood together last. A moment ago, I was occupying my brain with inconsequential games like jealousy, like vanity, like Anatole. And then a man swings a revolver and changes the whole world. Renders the previous world unrecognizable. Renders the thrum of Anson's tendons the pivot around which this new world whirls.
The thing is, he says, entirely unaware of the newfound import of his tendons. Are you sure you want to know?
Why not?
Presuming the owner of these buttons is really your father, and that may not be the case. We already know he's the kind of man who seduces showgirls, gets them with child, and then discards them.
You may not want to know him. He may not want to be known.
I realize all that. I'm just curious, that's all.
For what purpose?
Well, for one thing, you can't imagine the trouble, fretting about whether or not your present lover might turn out to be some kind of cousin.
His head jerks a bit.
Oh, yes, just think. Why, even you and I might be brother and sister for all I know.
We're not.
How do you know?
Because my father didn't go to Harvard.
Well, I can't tell you how relieved I am to hear that.
He sort of catches himself, turns his gaze first to my mama's enamel box, and then to the window. Puts his hands to the back of his neck.
I believe the color of his skin warms to a delicate pink, though the light is too gray to properly tell. Now, I can't say why I offered up this observation, the way I might offer up some mere scrap of flirtatious banter in the middle of a dull evening downstairs at Christopher's, or else uptown at some swank knees up among the Avenue set. I expect it has something to do with the relief of escape, the pure exhilaration of not finding yourself lying on the floor of a village powder room inside a puddle of your own blood. And the fella who saved you stands before you like some kind of conqueror. And nature, which runneth deep inside the marrow of your bones, you know, and can't be ignored. Now bangs in your eardrums, heats up your skin, demands you repay the debt you owe him. Offer up your frail human form as the spoils of war. No doubt the scientists have some clever name for this ancient instinct. All I know is that I have lost all recollection of any other man who might once have stood in this room with me. All thought of danger or mystery or hope of salvation. Just this dear, blushing face, and those tendons, and that well-pressed lapel and everything that lies beneath. Just the hot, living thrill of his blood, and the hot, living thrill of mine. Wouldn't you? But that Anson, maybe he's not like you and me. I don't know. I'm starting to think I don't know the first thing about men, and maybe I never did. He just stares out the window with grief in his eyes, and he starts to button up that overcoat, kind of clumsy because of the bandage on his right hand. Let me help you.
I've got it.
I step forward and brush away his hands and button up that overcoat. And when I'm done, I lay my palms on his lapels and look up into that face of his. Those eyes again, grieved and snowy. Thanks for helping a girl out downstairs.
There's nothing to thank me for. It's my job, that's all. I promise to keep you safe in all this.
And you never break a promise, do you?
No.
Above our heads and somewhere to my left, the ceiling creaks, the pipes flush. We've been speaking in whispers mostly because the walls are so thin and the occupants so nosy. But a moment like this, you realize just how loud a few words can be, just how easily overheard. I think about that word, no, and how he might have said, not if I can help it, or so long as it's in my power, or some other mealy qualification. But he didn't. He just said no, clean and simple. I hear myself say, terribly soft, you can kiss me if you like. He takes in a little breath. Just a little goodbye kiss to settle the nerves. Nobody needs to know. His hands close over the blades of my shoulders. His eyelids grow heavy. I might swear the eyes behind them seem a little warmer, like someone lit a flame inside his skull. If I rise to my toes, I can brush the tip of his nose with the tip of mine. I can press my lips on his and see if they soften. But before I fix my resolve to do any or all of these things, he leans forward and touches his mouth to my forehead.
Good night, Miss Kelly, he says.
His hands grasp mine and lift them away from his lapels. And you would not believe a pair of fists that crushed a man's jaw a half hour earlier could apply themselves now with such gentleness. I stand there a minute, my hands folded between his,
as if he held together in some kind of mutual prayer. Not speaking. Just staring at our bound hands. His swallowing mine. Bones and joints and skin. The smell of human longing. "Good night," he says again. A true whisper. And he sets my hands to my sides and opens the window. And he's gone. 19. Now, it seems Agent Anson is correct in his speculations and assurances, at least insofar as Duke Kelly's concerned, because Mrs. Washington hands me a fat brown envelope the morning after next, just as I'm stepping out the door for my bracing 9 o'clock plunge into the tapping pool. Her expression is not best pleased. "A gentleman left this for you first thing this morning." She renders the word gentleman inside a heavy skillet of irony. "How kind. Thank you terribly, Mrs. Washington. And another thing. You were making a real racket the other night, Miss Kelly. A real racket." "Was I? 1,000 apologies. I must have been talking in my sleep." "I thought I heard a man's voice in there with you." "A man's voice? But that's altogether impossible, Mrs. Washington. Why, you know very well I received no gentleman callers last night. What do you think? I've got them shimmying up the drain pipe? I know what I heard." "How very strange. Are you certain? What was he talking about, this fellow you think you heard?" "Something about Harvard, Miss Kelly." "Harvard? You mean that college in Massachusetts? And Pinkerton guards." "Pinkerton guards in Harvard? Now that's salacious. I don't wonder you were shocked." "It's what I heard, as if you didn't know." "Mrs. Washington, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm afraid I haven't got time to wonder at your fertile imagination just now. Do it work any minute. But if this kind of thing goes on, hearing imaginary voices in the middle of the night, I think maybe you should see a doctor." I tuck the envelope into my pocketbook and turn for the door. "They've got miraculous pills these days. Take care of all your troubles. Miss Kelly." But I'm afraid to say, I let the door fall shut on the rest of that sentence. Wasn't going anywhere useful, was it? 20. According to the instructions inside the envelope, I'm supposed to deliver the sordid contents to a fellow named McDuff at some address on Broad Street at 12:15 this afternoon. McDuff, I think. Lord almighty, there goes my lunch break. But when I arrive at said address at a few minutes prior to the appointed time, the place turns out to be a luncheonette, all cheap and new and white-painted, trimmed in chromium steel, windows turning back the glare of the winter sun, you know the spot, perched on the corner, hot soup for a nickel. When I open the door, a gust of steam rushes out into the street, smelling of grease and cigarettes. Inside, the waitresses scurry. It's a young, lowly crowd, the kind that can't afford a nice juicy beefsteak at Delmonico's, stenographers and clerks and typists like me, hair bobbed and lipstick fading fast, suit jackets wilting in the artificial heat. The chatter comes fast and hard as the clickety-clack racket of a tapping pool. I take hold of a passing waitress and ask her if she happens to know the whereabouts of a fellow named McDuff. "McDuff?" she asks harried, as in, "You putting me on, sister?" "That's right, Mr. McDuff." "Never heard of him. Go look for yourself." She pulls her arm away, and as she's balancing 4 bowls of boiling soup on a small wooden tray, I allow her the privilege. Around me, the tables are filled, scarce an empty chair, and surely no crisp-suited gentleman, who might or might not be on the lookout for a companion from behind a newspaper or something. Likewise, the dozen stools at the lunch counter stand occupied, except for a seat at the end now draped by somebody's lumpy charcoal overcoat. I make for the gap and tap its neighbor on the shoulder. "Pardon me. Do you mind removing your..." A porcelain face turns up toward mine. So bare and plain, I might not have recognized it. except for a single platinum curl dipping beneath the rim of a cloche hat to touch the arch of a perfect eyebrow. "Not at all," she says. 21. I settle on the stool and take out a cigarette. McDuff? It's easy to remember. Millicent McDuff. I don't suppose you happen to have a genuine moniker, do you? Something your mama used to call you. She lifts her coffee. It's not important. Suit yourself. I signal for the counter attendant and make my hand like a cup of coffee. So what's a nice girl like you doing mixed up in a business like this? I might ask the same of you. Isn't it obvious? I need the dough. I doubt it. You've already got a nice little income, haven't you? Smiling for the camera. Not anymore. I quit the indecency business yesterday. Oh, for what reason? For one thing, the money's better in the bribery racket. Do you want your envelope now, or do we enjoy a nice civilized lunch first? She stubs out the last of her cigarette. There's nothing in the envelope. Just blank paper. Oh, and how do you know that? Because I sent it to you myself. I swear. The coffee arrives in a clatter. I reach for Millie's cream and sugar. Aren't you going to ask why? She says. I'm waiting for you to start. I reckon you've got something to say to me, don't you? That's why we're here. Millie makes a noise of maybe a cent and extracts another cigarette from the silver case reclining against her saucer. Her fingers are long and nimble and bony, her nails varnished in crimson. But it's her face that fascinates me, the change in her. Unpainted, she looks all faded and monochrome, even her eyelashes, like somebody unplugged a drain beneath her chin and emptied her of color. She lights the gasper and enjoys a long, pensive drag. And by the time she pauses to consider the pattern of smoke curling forth from her lips, I've more or less run out of both coffee and patience. Well, what's the news? I haven't got all afternoon. You sure like to cut to the chase, don't you, Miss Kelly? So would you, if you were due back at the tapping pool in 38 minutes, or else. A ham sandwich and a cup of tomato soup, please, I tell the counter attendant, who's just returned with the cream and sugar I don't need. He nods and turns away. From behind us comes a crash of china, a brief vacuum of silence, a trill of laughter. The resumption of clickety-clack chatter. Let's begin with you, Miss McDuff, since we have to start somewhere. Just who's pulling your strings? My stepfather? Goodness, no. What an idea. I'm with the Prohibition Bureau, sweetheart. No kidding. You and Anson together? No, she says. Just me. I set down my cup and pluck the end of my cigarette from the ashtray, holding it betwixt my thumb and my forefinger, while a large gray crumb breaks away and crashes into the porcelain. You don't say. Oh, I do say. Then I'm afraid I don't understand. My dear girl, don't you see? You've been tricked. You've been bamboozled. Our dear Mr. Anson doesn't work for the government. He's in business for himself. Get lost. What kind of rube do you think I am? Look, I don't blame you for falling for him. I'll bet he took you to his office, didn't he? Made it look all official. Fed you the best story in the world. But the truth is, he was kicked out of the New York City agency a few months ago. Baloney. No, it's true. He was on the take, see, feathering a nice little nest for himself. I laugh. Now I know you're feeding me a line. Anson on the take. I never saw a straighter arrow than that one, and I know from scoundrels, believe me. Look, I'm not going to waste my breath. I just wanted to warn you, that's all. He's not what he seems. It's all a front, see? The ham sandwich slides into place before me. The soup in its cup, steam rising, butter melting to a small, speckled yellow pool in the center. I glance up to thank the counter boy, and he's given me a strange look, brows all bent. "Everything all right, miss?" he asks.
"Just fine, thanks."
"Look," says Millie, "you just think about it, all right?"
"I don't need to think about it. For one thing, why isn't he in jail? If he was caught on the take, like you say."
"Because he's got mighty friends, sweetheart. Mighty friends. The kind of friends even the Bureau doesn't dare to cross. You don't think he came from nowhere, do you? So they kicked him out. But they couldn't throw the book at him, and they didn't. And when Duke Kelly asked him to bring you in, why, he was more than happy to oblige, in exchange for a cut of the action. Says you, 'Didn't he pick me up from the police station? After that raid on Christopher's, you saw everything. You were right in that cell with me.' Say, I'll bet it's all the other way around, isn't it? I bet you're the rat working the double cross. Staked out the joint, called in the raid. Or else maybe you're trying to rat out Anson because he raided your daddy's joint and hauled you off to jail."
"What, me and Christopher? You think we have a thing together?"
She laughs. "Look, I guess you've got no reason to believe a word out of my mouth. That's fair. I'm working my own angle, and maybe I should be glad it's got you fooled. A smart girl like you. One thing's for sure. I shouldn't be here right now wasting my time, blowing my cover like a silly fool, on account of I've got a soft heart and hate to see another girl wander into trouble like this. But that's what he does, you know. Fucking Anson. If I had a nickel for all the girls he's taken in, that square jaw and those thick shoulders, all the girls who think he's a fine upstanding fellow, just about made of virtue." I snatch my pocketbook from the countertop and hunt for a dollar bill. My fingers are trembling, my ears roaring. The brown envelope keeps getting in the way, so thick as it is. I pull the damn thing free and toss it in Millie's lap, and the roll of bills appears at last, wedged in the bottom next to the rip in the lining. I strip away an ace and lay it on the counter, crumpled greenback against bright new aquamarine blue. The ham sandwich sits untouched on the plate, turning my stomach. "Keep the change," I say. "And go to hell." She shrugs. "Fine, then. Have it your way. Don't say I didn't warn you." "Oh, you warned me, all right. And trust me, I'll be passing along this interesting information right where it belongs. You do that. See what he says. Although you might want to start by visiting those offices of his on 10th Avenue." She stubs out her cigarette in the ashtray and inspects my ham sandwich. "I'd love to know what you find there." 22. I'm not the least bit inclined to follow Millie McDuff's advice. For one thing, I'm due back at the tap and pull in, check watch, 27 minutes, and for seconds, who wants to give the dame that kind of satisfaction? On the other hand, here I am, striding not toward the familiar corner of Wall and Broad, but southwestward toward the Battery, tossing my cigarette stub on the cold pavement and fishing for a nickel in my jacket pocket. What do you know? I tell myself, as I inhale the sharp, sunlit atmosphere and listen for the telltale sing of the elevated tracks, that I'm making this journey out of caution, not suspicion. I've got to warn Anson about this Millicent McDuff, warn him in person, not over the telephone to some kind of doll who might or might not be the kind of doll you can trust. And maybe he'll be sitting at his desk and maybe he won't, who knows. But the urgency of the situation demands my best efforts, does it not? I owe him that much for saving my life, for almost kissing me in my bedroom last night, I mean, on the forehead like a gentleman, when he might have claimed any reward he wanted. And what fellow kisses a willing girl on the forehead in the privacy of her own bedroom? Unless he's an honorable fellow, and maybe he's a little in love with her. So Anson's a fellow I can rely on, and Miss McDuff is made of rotten phonous balonus. And by the time I've spilled off the train at 23rd Street and descended to the hubbub of 9th Avenue, I can just about taste the indignation at the back of my throat, sort of like the homemade variety of gin, only more sour. By now it's almost 1 o'clock, and I should be sliding into place before my typewriter this exact second, tucking gloves and hat into the drawer, and straightening my collar for the benefit of Miss Atkins' patience, Quite possibly I lose my job over this little whim, unless that praying mantis upstairs sees fit to protect me. The wind shrieks off the Hudson River and down the sharp, straight streets, finds the cracks in my coat, turns the legs numb beneath their stockings. I turn up my collar and smash my hat closer over my ears, and I set out westward through the fragrant confluence of manure and garbage and gasoline exhaust, in the direction of that shrill whistle floating over the wind and the dirty brick buildings, the sound of the New York Central traversing 10th Avenue, up the Hudson Shore and down to the West Side Station, all the livelong day. 23. Now, I haven't experienced this corner of Manhattan Island since that startling night at the end of January, when a certain Mr. Anson first intruded my notice. And why should I? Nobody sets out in this particular direction unless she's got dirty New York business to transact, or else an ocean liner to board. But I remember it well. The cobblestones crusted with slush, now gone. The boarded-up saloon on the corner of 10th Avenue and 22nd Street. The tarnished brass plaque outside, which I now take time to read. H.L. Hewitt, Legal Advice and Private Investigations, 2nd Floor. I try the doorknob. Locked, of course. I bang on the door, just like my old friend Brooklyn did that night. Only this time, nobody comes to open it. No noise of any kind reaches me from the other side of the stoop. I crane my head one way, and another, as if that will help, and step back to crane my head upward. Windows closed and dusty. Abandoned aspect overall. No sign of occupation by any members of the New York Office of the Bureau of Internal Revenue. No sign of occupation whatever. Bang, bang. Desperate now. Bang, bang, bang. I step back and cut my hands around my mouth and holler upward. Hello there. Anybody in? What the hell you doing, lady? I spin around. Man standing there on the sidewalk, dressed in a cheap brown suit, lunch pail dangling from one hand, staring at me like you stare at a leper. There's an office here, I say, on the 2nd floor. Nobody's answering the door.
An office, ma'am?
Yes, I was here a month ago. A regular office.
You mean the Dick? Why, he moved out a couple years ago.
No, the Prohibition Bureau. They've got an office here. He starts to laugh.
Prohies? Not here, ma'am. You got a bum steer. Nobody been in them rooms for years. Not since the Dick left. Building's up for sale.
You're wrong. I was inside that office at the end of January.
Sure you were, ma'am, and my uncle's the mayor. Maybe you need to lay off the sauce a little.
Oh, yeah? Maybe you need to mind your own potatoes, Buster.
Sue yourself, he shrugs. You just keep on banging and see if anybody opens up. I gotta get back to work.
Yeah, thanks for nothing.
Anytime.
He pauses, gives me the old up and down, pats his right front pocket.
Say, I get off at 5 if you're still around. Buy you a drink or something. Got paid yesterday.
Get lost, I say, and I turn around and bang on the door again, just as if I'm expecting somebody to open it. 24. 10 minutes later, I'm around back, climbing up the fire escape, because that's the kind of optimistic broad I am. Determined to discover some kind of life inside this damn building. Determined to prove the perfidy of Miss McDuff. At the 2nd floor landing, the window is locked tight. But when I climb up to the next floor, my luck is in. The wooden sash groans and gives way under my urging. I work it up a foot or two and lever my body inside, head and shoulders and hips, like going forth from the womb, I guess. Except this world I'm entering is cold and damp and smells of mold. And as I tumble free onto a hideous rotten carpet, a strange feeling mushrooms inside me. The same gut sickness that used to warn me when it was time to skedaddle back home in River Junction. But I am not cowed. Nobody and nothing cows Ginger Kelly. I scramble up from said carpet and brush my skirt, straighten my hat and my collar and my pocketbook over my elbow. The hall is dark, not a single lamp lit, and quiet as death, except for the noise of Manhattan streaming under the window sash and through the pores in the brickwork. To the left runs the stairway, battered and dirty, leading up to God knows and down to Anson's office, the office into which Brooklyn dragged me at the end of January, desk and chair and hot coffee brought in by a navy-suited doll of some kind, and Anson himself, still and stern and mountainous, clean and straight and true, draping his jacket over my shoulders against the chill in the air, driving me home through a whirling of new snow. You know, up until this point, I don't believe I've properly understood just how far I've fallen, just how goofy I've gone for a pair of reliable shoulders and a glacial gaze that might or might not contain a small amount of tenderness for me. Ginger Kelly, bastard Appalachia hillbilly, red-haired, smart-mouthed, whose bubs could be bought for a dime a time at any old news agent in town. The enormity of my crush on Special Agent Anson, its exact mass and dimensions, such that the possibility of betrayal seems to threaten the smooth operation of every single less vulnerable organ of my body. As I stand there, in that hallway, regarding the shadowy length of the staircase, its dark ending at the second floor landing, the sensation of sickness grows and grows, vibrates the delicate molecules of blood that runneth along my veins and into my heart. I tell myself, stern-like, don't be a coward, Jin. Get a hold of yourself. And maybe my blood obeys that command, and maybe it doesn't, but I guess enough will remains pulsing inside said veins to engage my gams in the terrible act of walking down the staircase toward the darkness at the end. Because that's what I do. Walk down the staircase, step by step, until I'm standing inside that shadow, and it's not so bad, really, like any other shadow, dissolving by the light from the dirty window. I turn up the hallway. Anson's office, remember, lay on the front side of the building, overlooking the street. And I tread down the mildewed carpet until I reach the last door, swinging easily open under my touch, room empty, desk bare, no paper or pens or telephone or anything, just nothing but a few sticks of familiar furniture covered in a layer of dust, cold, damp air, a sliver of light finding the edge of the window as the winter sun slides west. I sit down on the armchair before the desk and stare at that sliver of sunlight, the ghost shapes of the buildings on the other side of the glass. 25. For some reason, I'm not surprised to find a familiar yellow Hudson Roadster parked on the street outside the Sterling Bates building on the corner of Wall and Broad when I return for work a half hour later. "Billy boy," I say, as soon as I can extract myself from between the lapels of his overcoat. His face is sweet and bright, his smile wide, his brown eyes open for business. "What the devil are you doing here?" He takes me by the shoulders, kisses me, takes me by the hands and kisses those two, one by one. When he lifts his head again, his cheeks are as pink as two fresh hams. "Why, isn't it obvious, darling? We're eloping."
New York City, 1998. All the articles, all the books, the whole humming database of girlfriend wisdom, everyone said the same thing. You should know if your husband's cheating on you. Why? Because most men aren't James Bond, not skilled at the meticulous art of covert operations. The secrecy, the evasion, the unexplained dinners and business trips, the call history on his cell phone, the mystery charges on his credit card. Any alert wife knows when she has something to fear. All she needs is proof. But until that evening 4 weeks ago, Ella never suspected a thing. Everything seemed perfectly normal, perfectly married and domestic. They just made love the night before. There was nothing weird about the way he touched her or kissed her. Same Patrick as ever. Except they'd been officially trying for a baby for a year now, and she wasn't getting pregnant. And after he pulled out, she rolled over and turned her back to him so he wouldn't engage her in the usual desperate, awkward, post-coital banter about this one definitely doing the trick. So maybe it was her fault, turning her back like that after a round of perfectly good sex. Maybe he felt lonely and hurt and disconnected from her, from the whole mechanical business of baby-making. From the failure of any of Ella's eggs to accept the amazing gift of Patrick. And that was why, the next evening, he slapped Ella's knee and insisted on being the one to collect the delivery pizza from downstairs. Except he always insisted. That wasn't new. He was such a gentleman. But this time, fatefully, Ella had risen from the sofa to fetch a glass of water from the kitchen. And in doing so, she'd passed the hooks in the entryway and realized she'd left her laptop bag in the residence gym. So, she'd taken the stairs down to the gym. She always took the stairs, and when she turned the corner of the stairwell in between the third floor and the second floor, where the gym lay, she heard some noise coming from below. The damp, breathless efforts of two people screwing. She got flustered and turned to bolt, but then the perv in her spoke up and demanded to catch a glimpse of this interesting, furtive act and see who it was. Who among her neighbors was maybe cheating on a girlfriend or boyfriend or wife or husband? She could tell Patrick all about it when he returned with the pizza. And even then... My God, even then, it never occurred to her, when she peeked around the edge of the concrete slab, that it might be Patrick's pale, muscular buttocks. Patrick's ragged breath. Patrick's hands around the wrists of some pneumatic, lycra-clad woman with long, fine, fried blonde hair. Ella could still remember the exact color and texture of that hair, bracing her against the cinder block wall while he humped her furiously from behind. Shorts around his ankles. Oh, baby, the woman said, and Patrick shouted, fuck, fuck, here it comes, and shoved one more time, sticking himself deep inside the woman for several seconds. Releasing one of her wrists to grab a tanned, enormous breast, groaning like he might die. A couple of final twitches, shoulders go slack, then withdrawal in a rush, panting hard, semen dribbling from the end of his bare penis, parting slap to a bottom like a navel orange. And that... was when Ella turned back around and climbed the stairs in silent, fairy steps. She sat down on the sofa and stared at the flickering television. Not even 90 seconds later, Patrick bounded through the door and said, "Hey, babe, pizza's here." Just exactly as if he had not been fiercely fucking another woman 2 minutes earlier, had not just ejaculated inside another woman's vagina. He opened the box on the kitchen counter, pulled out a couple of plates, put a slice on each one, and asked her if she wanted salad. She said no. He brought the plates to the coffee table and set hers down before her, picked up his slice, and started eating, pitched forward, elbows resting on his thighs. Fixed entirely on the flat, colorful images on the screen before them. She stared at the hair on his nearby knee. He always changed into shorts when he got home. And she rose from the sofa and said she had to go to the bathroom. When she walked out a few minutes later, she took a path behind the sofa so he wouldn't see she was carrying a gym bag. "We're out of milk?" she said in a perfectly normal voice. "Be back in a sec." So absorbed was Patrick in whatever it was they'd been watching. ER, probably, since it was Thursday night. He didn't even consider how strange it was that she would leave to buy a quart of milk while her pizza went cold on its plate. He just said, "Sure, babe." And she walked out the door, just like that. And those were the last words they spoke. Until yesterday. Until now. Sitting across from each other, a round, blonde Starbucks table between them. Ella arrived early so she could buy her own drink. She was going to order her usual latte, but decided on a double espresso instead in a small ceramic mug. No milk or sugar. Patrick nodded at the cup.
"Changed your drink?"
"I'm changing a lot of things."
"Good for you. Good for you."
Like he hadn't actually heard her. He tapped the plastic lid of his own cup, jiggled his knee.
"So, where do we start?"
She spread her hand. "You were the one who wanted to meet."
"We had to meet. We're married, for God's sake."
"Oh, now you think of that." Before he could open his mouth to reply, she went on. "So I had myself checked for STDs, full screen. Came back clean, thank God. Dodged that bullet. But I'm supposed to go in again in a few months."
"Come on, Ella."
"You should probably get yourself checked, too. Riding bareback with prostitutes is pretty risky."
"Shit, Ella."
He looked down and mumbled.
"I made sure she was clean."
How exactly? Did you ask her first, before you screwed? Well, surprise, surprise, she tells you she's good to go. What about the others?"
"There weren't any others. It was a one-time thing, I swear."
"A one-time thing?"
"I swear. I was so stressed out. Stuff going on at work, and the whole baby thing. Everyone pregnant but us."
"Seriously? You're seriously telling me you hired a prostitute because you couldn't get your wife pregnant?" His face went sharp and pink at the edges, like he was about to snap something back. Which was what she wanted, really. She wanted him snapping. She wanted him just as mad as she was. But he wouldn't give it to her. He took in a deep breath instead, sipped his coffee, said quietly,
"I know it doesn't make sense. I wanted this so bad. Want this so bad. Want us to be a family, Ella. Watch my wife growing our baby and kids running around all over the place. And I didn't want you to see how stressed I was that it wasn't happening and, like, blame yourself or anything. I felt like I was going to explode. And it was stupid. Okay? Stupidest thing I ever did. I have no idea what made me do it, but it won't happen again."
He was speaking fluently now, in short, rote sentences of contrition.
"I started seeing a therapist right after you left. I'm working through everything, so it's done. Finished. Over. Happened once, never again."
He reached across the table, but Ella moved her hand away. "Do you really think," she said in slow, careful words, "I'm actually that stupid?" Patrick's uncertain eyes stared back at her. For a man whose wife had just left him, whose marriage and life had just imploded, he looked remarkably well-rested, skin clear, eyes fresh, hair shining. His lips were a little chapped. They always were, and now hung open. The expression was somehow familiar. She couldn't place how. She leaned forward a few inches. "Just because I didn't see this coming doesn't mean I can't see the whole picture now that the shades are off, okay? That wasn't the first time. Are you kidding me? What are the odds? The one time you cheated, I miraculously happened to catch you. Come on. You were fucking her like an expert. You knew exactly what you were doing. Slapped her ass afterward for good luck. Then you pulled up your shorts and waltzed into that apartment and lied to me like you'd been practicing that all your life, too. And I'll bet you have. Now she could identify the expression on his face. That of a dog, caught on the kitchen table, eating a sandwich left behind while the owner went upstairs to put the laundry in the dryer. Haven't you, Patrick? Come clean. She wasn't the first. How long have you been hiring hookers to help you with your stress issues? And it's probably not just hookers, either. That's the quick and easy solution, right? When you have your choice and a little more time on your hands, you go to some bar after work and find a cute girl to pick up and have hot sex in the bathroom, or else go back to her place and hump on the futon while her roommate watches TV. Am I right? And why stop there? So many young analyst bunnies at the bank. So little time. An office affair is a great way to keep some nookie on standby whenever you need a little help with your stress. Now he was turning pale. She could actually see the blood draining from his face while the adrenaline pummeling through her own veins at this unparalleled act of confrontation made her almost dizzy. Stoned out of her mind, her legs and fingers twitched, like she could run a marathon at a full sprint. Poor Patrick. You're stressed. I get that. I was stressed, too, but I didn't go out and pick up some guy from a bar and screw him in the alley, did I? I mean, that never even occurred to me, because I'm married to you. I'm supposed to have sex with only one man for the rest of my life, and that's you. And I knew that was the deal when we got married, and I accepted it joyfully. I plighted you my fucking troth. So are you saying it's now okay for us to have sex with other people?
No, of course not. I mean, what I did was wrong. I admit it.
Because there's this really hot guy in my new building. I bet he'd be amazing in the sack. Young and super fit. He could go all night. I should really try him out after work. Take care of my stress and all.
Patrick leaned his head into his hands like he was about to throw up.
Anyway, you go on sitting there trying to figure out some new lie to spin to me. Starts out with a confession.
Right, fine. You got me. There were others. I just didn't want to hurt your feelings.
And then the revised version of events.
I've only been doing it for a month or so. It was a cry for help. I actually wanted you to find out so we could resolve all our unspoken issues.
But you don't need to bother, Patrick. It's okay. The when and where and how many doesn't matter. You've probably been screwing other women all along since we first started going out. It's who you are. It's in your DNA or whatever. You're a cheater. You just are. There's nothing you or I or some fucking psychiatrist can do about it. We could talk about it all day. You could tell me every detail. We could spend $1 million on therapy. We could probably have you castrated and you would still find a way to spread a little bit of Patrick around. Let's be honest about that, at least.
Patrick just stared at the table. Fingers speared through his hair. Around them, the ordinary business of Starbucks went on, line ebbing and flowing, grind of coffee beans overpowering the air, wet whir of steaming milk. Dull chatter. Some kind of Sinatra music laying itself on the walls. The smell of strong, burned coffee. Ella finished her espresso, which had grown sweet with age.
So that's where we stand, Patrick. That's our current status. And the only question is, do I try to understand what it's like to be inside your skin? To sympathize with this biological destiny of yours and the guilt and pain it's probably causing you, you know, loving your wife while still needing to screw around with hookers and whatever. I mean, unless you're a complete psychopath.
Of course I feel guilty. Jesus, Ella. I've been tearing myself apart. Everything we built together.
Everything we built? Newsflash. You destroyed it, Patrick. You did. It's gone.